Thank you, Tyler, for those songs tonight. These guys do a great job, Tyler and Drew and the other young men who are involved in our worship service. They do a great job. It takes a lot of courage for them to stand up here in front of all of you and do what they do. And I'm very, very proud of them and very thankful to them for the job that they do. I'm going to share something with you tonight that I don't think I've ever shared with you before. It's a little bit about my childhood, about my past. I don't know if you probably don't know this about me, but I was a mean kid growing up. When I was younger, when I was, you know, first, second grade, and even when I got into middle school and high school, I was not very nice. We moved out into the country, and I remember the very first Christmas that we were there. I woke up that morning, and I went out into the living room, into the Christmas tree, and there was what I had wanted for so long. It was a BB gun. This is the best present that an 8-year-old boy could possibly ask for. And as I picked it up, I couldn't help but remember, you know, the Christmas story. You'll shoot your eye out. Luckily, I didn't do that. But as I grew up, you got to have something to shoot your BB gun at, right? My best friend would come over to the house, and we would go out onto the land, out into the country, and through the woods, shooting as many birds as we possibly could in an afternoon. And sometimes it was really ridiculous how many you could shoot. I mean, it's crazy. But we would shoot the birds, and we would usually just leave them there. We didn't do anything with them. We were just there. I don't know why we did it. And then we had cows, and I had a dog that chased the cows, and my dad didn't like that, so I thought, well, I'll help my dad out. And so I would take my BB gun, and I would shoot my dog as he was chasing the cows. He never quit. I don't know why. I was somewhat of a tormentor. I had a little sister, and any of you out there who have a little sister know what your duty is as a big brother. It is to make their life miserable. I was very good at that. That was my home life, and I would go to church. And there was this kid at church. I won't tell you his name. But you know the kid that I'm talking about. There's always one of them, no matter what church you went to, no matter what school you went to. There was always this kid that was just asking to be made fun of, right? The one who was a little bit different, okay? This guy was different. He didn't belong in the group that I was in with all of my friends. He was different. His family didn't have the money that the rest of our families had, you know? It was a little bit tougher for them to get by. They didn't have as nice a house as I grew up in. The clothes that he wore very often had holes all over them. When he would come into church, it looked like he just woke up in the morning. His hair was everywhere. Sometimes it was very evident that he hadn't had a bath or a shower or anything like that in several days because you couldn't hardly stand to get within about 5 feet of him. When he would read scripture in class, he had a little bit of lisp. He had a speech problem. He was different. His family life wasn't anywhere near what my family life was. I can't even imagine what it was like for him at home. We made fun of this guy. We made fun of his clothes. We made fun of his hair. We made fun of the way that he talked, when he would stumble over his words as he was reading in class. We avoided him. In class, when we would walk in and he would already be there, and maybe he would even be in our chair, we would sit on the other side of the room because he was different and we didn't want to be close to him. When we would go into the auditorium for church, for worship, he didn't sit with us. We didn't let him sit with us. He was the outcast. And even when we would see him at school as we were passing by in the hall, because he was the different kid, he was the kid that we looked the other way and pretended like he wasn't there. You know what I'm talking about, because we've all done it. We excluded him. After church, when we would go out into the parking lot to play games, throw a football, throw a frisbee, or just chase each other around, we didn't let him play because he was slow. He was big. He was different. By the time middle school rolled around, we saw him at church very rarely. He wasn't there very much. And by the time high school rolled around, we didn't see him at all. And to this day, I can't tell you where he is. I don't know what happened to him. It's a sad story. It hurts me to tell you this story. But it hurts me even worse to tell you that after he quit coming, so did his family. His little sister, his mom and dad. I don't know where they're at. I haven't seen them in years. All of this because of that word different. He wasn't like me and my friends. He didn't look like us. He didn't talk like us. He didn't dress like us. Because he was different. How many of you have known that kid in your lives? We've all done it. Nothing that I'm proud of. I don't tell you this story to boast tonight. Some of us maybe even were that kid. I don't know, growing up. But as we look at our lesson tonight, as Drew read for us out of Hebrews chapter 11, the great roll call of faith, as we get down around in verse 32, as we're reading about Abel and the sacrifice that he offered, as we read about Enoch and how he walked with God, as we read about Noah and the faith that it took to build the ark, and Abraham and Isaac, and the list goes on and on and on. And we come down to verse 32, as the Hebrew writer says, and who else can I list? I don't have the time, I don't have the space on the piece of paper that I'm writing about to tell you about the others, to tell you about Gideon, about Barak, about Samson, about David. And the one in the middle there, his name is Jephthah. He doesn't have time to tell you about that. Look at all the company that this man is with. Jephthah stands out to me because he is different. I don't know if you know that about him or not. I want you to take your Bibles, turn back to Judges chapter 11. That's where we find the story of Jephthah. You know, he's just mentioned his name there. We don't give many details about him. But as we flip back to Judges chapter 11, we encounter his story. Read with me just the first, I don't know, about three verses. It says that now Jephthah of Gilead was a great warrior. He was the son of Gilead, but his mother was a prostitute. Gilead's wife also had several sons, and when these half-brothers grew up, they chased Jephthah off the land. You will not get any of our father's inheritance, they said, for you are the son of a prostitute. So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. Soon he had a band of worthless rebels following him. Jephthah. This is the man that's listed in the same sentence as Gideon, as David, and as Samuel. And this is where he came from. I like the way the author starts out. It says that Jephthah was a great warrior. What a great accolade is that for somebody to have written about him that he was good at what he did. But then we find one of those great things in the Bible where the Bible doesn't spare all the dirty details. He lets us know exactly who Jephthah was. In the very next sentence, it says that his mother was a prostitute, which means that he was an illegitimate child. Jephthah was a different man. Jephthah, by all rights, does not belong in the list that we read in Hebrews chapter 11. You can almost picture the scene here. The first three verses, they do it very quickly. But you can almost picture this scene in Gilead, can't you? There's a rumor of scandal in the town of Ramah. A rumor of something that happened that shouldn't have happened, and now there's a child because of it. As it spreads through the town, secrets are hard to keep, aren't they? Especially in small towns. I grew up in a small town. There weren't many secrets. There wasn't many things that I did that my parents didn't ever find out about. Even in a town like Springfield, as big as it is, it's hard to keep a secret, isn't it? You can almost picture early in the morning as all the women get up and they get ready to prepare the meals for the day. They go out into the city. They go to the well to get the water. This was the gathering place of all the women, so you can only imagine what was going on here. All the gossip that was being told. You know, you come early and you stay late to make sure that you don't miss anything, that you've got all the juicy details of the story so you can go back and repeat the story. And after a while, it becomes apparent that the rumor is true. You can tell that the prostitute is pregnant, that she's going to have a baby, and everybody knows who the father is. Everybody, you know, they don't come out and say it, you know, they probably whisper it as he walks by. You know, they see, here comes Gilead as he walks by the crowd, and they say, oh, that's the guy, he did it. He did it. I heard about it at the well just this morning. But unlike a lot of men, Gilead owns his mistake. He does the right thing. He takes his son, he takes him into his house and raises him as his own son. What a great gesture from a man who probably didn't have to do what he did, but he did it anyways. He brings him into his house. Gilead is a good guy, I think. But what do you think life was like for his wife? You think it was an easy thing? You know, how do you think she felt about all that? Here is your husband's illegitimate child, the proof that he was unfaithful to you, and he's living in your house. That must have been a hard thing. In the course of time, other sons are born. Playmates for young Jephthah, if you would. They grow up together as kids. They're playing together in the family room. They get along great. You know, they have their fights like all brothers, but they're brothers. And that's how they are. As time goes by, though, these young men begin to be educated by their society. And they begin to look down on Jephthah. They know that Jephthah is the illegitimate child, the child that doesn't belong. And they begin to pick on him and make fun of him. Eventually, I believe Gilead dies. And the father figure, the patriarch, is no longer there to be in the middle of the brothers as they fight and as they pick on each other. And the situation explodes. You know, there, what was it in verse 2? He says, you will not get any of our father's inheritance. You are the son of a prostitute. What are they saying to him there? They're saying, Jephthah, you don't belong. You're not a part of this family. We don't want you. For whatever reason, Dad brought you into this house. But he's gone, and so are you. If we look at verse 7, it's apparent that Jephthah had made an appeal to the elders of that community, the older men, to intercede on his behalf, to be the dad that Gilead wasn't there to be anymore, to step in the middle and say, no, you've got to keep him, he's got to stay here with you. But apparently they didn't. The pillars of the community, the ones who were supposed to be the leaders, the one who all the people are supposed to follow, are the very ones who throw him out. Why? Because he's different. Does it sound like a familiar story? Yeah. The great thing here is that this misfit, this reject, the one that they threw out of town, is the very one that ends up saving Israel. The one who God chooses to bring back and save Israel. Let's just start at verse 4. It says that about this time the Amorites began their war against Israel. When the Amorites attacked, the elders of Gilead sent for Jephthah in the land of Tob. And the elders said, come and be our commander. Help us fight the Amorites. But Jephthah said to them, aren't you the ones who hated me and drove me from my father's house? Why do you come to me now when you're in trouble? Because we need you, the elders replied. If you lead us in battle against the Ammonites, we will make you ruler over all the people of Gilead. And Jephthah said to the elders, let me get this straight. If I come with you, and if the Lord gives me victory over the Ammonites, you will make me ruler over all the people. The Lord is our witness, the elders replied. We promise to do whatever you say. What a change in power, right? The rejected, the different one, the one that nobody wanted around, all of a sudden is the only one who can save Israel. If that's not irony in the story, I don't know what is. In the verses in between there, there's some discourse between Jephthah and the Ammonite king. And basically, the king ignores him. If we skip down into verse 29, we find probably what Jephthah is most famous for. Verse 29, it says, "At the same time, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he went throughout the land of Gilead and Manasseh, including Mizpah and Gilead, and from there he led the army against the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. He said, 'If you give me victory over the Ammonites, I will give to the Lord whatever comes out of my house to meet me when I return in triumph. I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering.'" And the crowd says, uh-oh. That doesn't sound like a good thing, does it? Here we have our hero. I imagine a grand scene as he marches through the land from city to city, recruiting his army, getting them all together, say, "We're going to go and we're going to free you from the bondage that you're in." He probably feels a little bit like a hero as he does this. And finally, the day of the battle comes, and as he's riding out into battle, he says, "God, if you will help me win this, if you'll help me do this." I don't know about you, but that sounds like something I've said a lot in my life. "God, if you will just let this happen for me. God, if you will just let me..." Right? It's almost like at this point he's trying to bribe God. I don't know why he felt the need to do this. Why he felt the need to say, "God, if you will do this for me, then I will sacrifice the first thing out of my house." There was no need for it at this point. In verse 29, it says that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. Can you imagine having anything else better behind you, backing you up, than the Spirit of the Lord? You remember Samson? What happened when the Spirit of the Lord came upon him? What a powerful thing. There was no need for the vow that Jephthah makes. And God holds him to it, doesn't he? God has a funny way of doing things sometimes to us, doesn't he? He holds us to our word. And he did that for Jephthah. Look in verse 34. It says that when Jephthah returned home from Mizpah, or to Mizpah, his daughter came out to meet him, playing on the tambourine and dancing for joy. She was his one and only child. He had no other sons or daughters. When he saw her, he tore his clothes in anguish. "And oh, my daughter," he cried out, "you have completely destroyed me. You've brought disaster on me, for I have made a vow to the Lord, and I cannot take it back." God holds him to it. He holds him responsible for the things that came out of his mouth. There's a lot of debate of what happens to her. Does she die? Doesn't she die? And that's not the point. That's not what I want to talk about tonight. The bottom line is, Jephthah messed it up. The man who is different, the reject, the guy who didn't belong, even once he gets there, he still messes it up. Excuse me. Jephthah was different. He didn't belong, and he also messed up. Out of his haste to get to the battle, I don't know why he decided that he needed to make that vow, but he did. And it's easy to read this story, to look at Jephthah, and to accuse him, isn't it? It's easy to get up and say and to tell you why you shouldn't be like Jephthah, why you don't need to do all of these stupid things that he did. But I want you to notice where he is listed. In Hebrews chapter 11, with all those great men of faith, in 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 11, he's listed there with the prophets and the judges before him. His faith is attested to by his actions. I also want you to notice his daughter. I believe that his faith is also attested to by his daughter. Look in verse 36 of chapter 11. The daughter says to him, "Father, if you have made a vow to the Lord, you must do to me what you have vowed. For the Lord has given you a great victory over your enemy, the Ammonites." The faith of that daughter, the faith that is in that statement, despite all of his shortcomings, despite being a different and rejected individual, he was still able to instill that kind of faith in his child. We could draw lots of parallels here through this story, but I want to bring this home for you. It's easy for us sitting in here to look out and to see all of Jephthah's problems. It's easy for us to look out and pass all of the usual judgments on Jephthah. But right now, I want you to take just a minute, and I want you to look inside. I want you to look inside yourself. I want you to pass some of those very same judgments that you would pass on Jephthah on yourself. How do we measure up? I think it's fair to say that a number of us could be Jephthah right now in our lives, couldn't we? We're messed up. We're different. It might not be our own fault, but it might be our fault. Sometimes you just can't help it. You know, there's always that family history, you know, whatever went on in the past that sometimes we try to cover up, we try to hide because we don't want people to know about it. You know, whether it is the illegitimate child, whether we grew up in an abusive household, whether we're here right now tonight with a facade of normalcy on our face, whether we're here pretending that it's all okay, that we've got it all together, and inside we really don't. Whether it's some of the choices that we've made in our lives, you know, we make choices as we grow up and as we get older that mess things up. Sometimes those things impact our kids, have a negative impact on our kids. Those choices that we make out of rashness, you know, some of those affect our spouse. Some of those affect our finances. Those choices that we make that just mess us up. You might be at one of the lowest points in your life right now. I don't know. But I want you to know that God has chosen you and that He loves you. He's chosen you to be a part of His kingdom. He loves you so much that He sent Jesus to this earth to die on the cross, to take all of that away. All those things that can mess our lives up can be gone in the blink of an eye. Because Jesus was here. Because God wants to be your close and personal friend. He wants to be known by you. I also want you to know tonight that this church loves you. And that this church cares about you. Churches really get caught up in this, don't they? As churches, I think sometimes we should equate ourselves to the women gathered around that well in the morning, shouldn't we? Spreading the gossip just as fast as we can possibly do it. We can't wait to get home to get on the phone and tell everybody what we heard about so-and-so at church, right? Or we're those brothers who passed the judgment because we know what you did when you were a teenager. We know what you did last night before you came to church tonight. We know. And because of that, you can't be a part of this church. I heard one person say once that a person can be fit for heaven but not for the assembly. What a terrible thing to say. I can't tell you how much I disagree with that. That's not the way that it should be. If somebody should find acceptance anywhere, it should be inside this room. It should be with this group of people. When people walk through the back doors, they should know that this is a community that loves them, that cares for them, and accepts them despite the choices they've made, despite the choices that have affected who they are today, no matter what they look like, no matter what they smell like. People need to know that we love them. I want to challenge this church tonight to fight this attitude. It's an easy attitude to adopt, isn't it? It's easy to be the ones on the outside making all the judgments. But guys, I don't want us to be a church like that. I want us to be the church that accepts. I want us to be the church that loves. Because who are we to choose who God uses? It's not up to us to choose God's church. It's not up to us to choose who's worthy enough to be part of this church, guys. God can use whoever He wants to. Jephthah, I don't know if you know this, wasn't even supposed to be part of the assembly. If you look in Deuteronomy chapter 23 and verse 2, it says that no one born of a forbidden union may enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. somebody that was born an illegitimate child, was not allowed into the assembly, even down to the 10th generation. That's a long time, folks. A long time that he wasn't supposed to be a part. But God chose a reject to save Israel. To save Israel then, and to save us now. I know that some of us in here tonight have flawed backgrounds. Some of us have made poor choices in our lives. But the one thing that I hope encourages us all is knowing that God can still work in your life. That God can still use you for good in His kingdom. Those are comforting words to me. If there's anything that we can help you with tonight, even if it's just as simple a thing as praying for you, I ask that you please come as we stand and sing.
Would you be